So basically, you know, she comes in with attitude immediately, and I'm engaged in an activity that I find enjoyable. So if you're gonna come at someone negatively, you should more likely expect a negative response. So the way I think it could have been avoided is, honey, I'm playing my game.
Okay, here's the right way to do it. All right. Honey?
Yes?
I just wanted to talk to you about something. Do you think you'll be done in a few minutes?
This is an online game. I won't be able to pause it, but I can talk to you in 15 minutes. Would that be fine?
Sure, we can do that.
All right.
Not a problem.
I'll see you in a little bit.
All right?
Yeah.
So we're learning, part of Mad About Marriage is just learning how to do things in a positive way. The first example we showed you definitely is how not to do it, and we hope at the end that showed you how to do it. And also I want to share with you just a few ways that, a few ways just to have happiness, which is what we're learning about, is how to make our marriages better, how to do things a better way so that we can not be mad in our marriages, we can actually have happiness. So here are a few things that we think can help you as far as happiness. I've learned that it's better to be married to someone with a good nature than a good physique.
And the second one is, I've learned that if you pursue happiness, it will elude you. But if you focus on your family, the needs of others, your work, meeting new people, and doing the very best you can, happiness will find you.
And at this time, we'd like to introduce our speakers, Gail and Mike, and they're going to give you some better examples of how we can keep on doing and keeping marriage happy and not mad. All right.
You guys want to go on the road with us?
That's good. That was awesome.
Way to go, guys. We only got about 12 more dates this year. Come on. Oh, dear.
Okay, I have to ask you if it's okay if I present in bare feet. Do you care? You can take your shoes off because I got my shoes off, right?
And I'll do you a favor and keep mine on.
Yeah. It gets too hard to stand in heels all afternoon, right?
Well, I wouldn't know, but I'll take your word for that.
It's true. Well, we want to talk today a little bit about the big stuff. And if you have your folder, should be the next sheet in there, then the next set of handouts. The big stuff is basically talking about those big negative issues that we mentioned last night that are kind of the premise of Mad About Marriage. The big stuff is life that gets in the way and some of the things that end up putting barriers between us. There is a quote that came from Marlo Archer, and she talks about what we dream of maybe compared to what the
reality
is, yeah. And the happily ever after versus the better or worse, the worst part. She says, little girls fantasize about their wedding day for years. They dream about the beautiful white dress, having their hair, makeup, and nails done like a movie star. Mm. They think about the music and the dancing and how all their friends will be there. There's the food and the cake and the gifts and the throwing of the bouquet and the prostate cancer.
Oh, wait. What?
The prostate cancer.
The prostate cancer.
You know, she says the prostate cancer or the loss of jobs or the deaths in the family or the financial stresses or whatever it happens to be.
Because all that's life.
All of those things are life. All of those things that get in the way and sometimes kind of overtake us. And I think it's worth taking the time to look at those things and say, you know, do we have them? Is it something we need to deal with?
Well, when we started with Mad About Marriage, we were asking the question, what is it that's ruining marriages in America today? What are the things that are doing that? And we looked at some of the really big issues, some of the big things. And those are the things that just make us mad. But we want to turn mad to madly in love. So we need to do that by addressing the big issues. And as long as the big issues are there, whether it's negative communication, which we talked about last night, or maybe some of these other things, as long as they're there, you can add all the niceties you want to add. And it's not going to help because all of it will seem disingenuous. It doesn't seem to be genuine when you tell me you love me and yet you're scolding me and nagging to me or or if you're having an affair or something of that nature, then it doesn't seem rather genuine, does it? So we've got to address the big issues to remove the negatives, and then when we add the positives, it really does something special for us.
So up on the screen right now, we want to put, again, the things that we mentioned last night as some of the big issues. And you may find that the big issues for you are different than these, but these are some that are really plaguing marriages in America today. And we think, well, you know, but we're Christians, and Christians don't have that same kind of thing going on. Well, yes, we do.
Yeah, we do.
Yes, we do. And the same things are happening in the church that are happening outside of the church. And I think we're better off to open our eyes than to close them and put blinders on. Now, the first four that you find up here, negative communication, forgiveness, lack of spirituality, and too little sexual intimacy, are things that everyone deals with. Every marriage, you have to somehow come to grips with all of those kind of things. So that's why those are parts of our major presentations. They kind of almost standalone presentations. These last six that pop up right now are things that don't exist in every marriage, but they exist in a lot of marriages. So we're going to take a little time in this session to talk more specifically about these issues right here that you see on the
screen. And we could add some to this list. One thing would be, grief. Grief has a way of separating couples. And we mentioned, I think, last night that the divorce rate for a couple who lose a child to death for the first 18 months is 50 to 70%. Over 5 years is 95%, because grief has a way of isolating us, and it destroys the relationship. A long-term illness would be another of a big issue.
Long-term illness, chronic illness, is that going to impact your marriage? Absolutely. You have to figure out how to deal with that, and it's something that can be a constant negative that's just pulling on you all the time. What about maybe if you're caring for elderly parents, or you have a sick child?
Trauma. How about depression? That's something people don't like to talk a lot about. But truthfully, everyone, I think one study said about 95 to 97% of Americans will experience at least one severe depression in your life. I think that may be a little bit low. I think that number may be low. But still, this is if indeed it's something that's chronic, one depression enough is enough to put a hurt on the marriage. But if it's chronic, then it really can be something that the two of you really need to struggle with in order to deal with.
Have to figure out how to work it out.
And it can be done. You can work it out. And those are things that's life. It's life, you know. And so
Absolutely.
We have to figure out how to do it. So let's talk just a little bit, if we could. Oh, wait a minute. There we go. I started to do the next one too quick, didn't I? We want to talk a little bit about finances first, and then talk a little bit about some of these others. And this is not in your notes, but we wanted to throw this in just for a little bit extra here, the finances.
You know, finances are one of the things that everybody has to deal with, right? How are we going to manage our money? Most couples are unprepared for the financial responsibility that comes with marriage. And that you can see how that happens, because most of the college students today, and I believe it's 76% that's estimated, that 76% of college students have credit cards. And on those credit cards, they owe an average of $3,100. Now, you add to that an average school loan debt of about $20,000, and you've got somebody there that's got, you know, $20,000 to $25,000 worth of debt. They are looking around, you know, they're young adults, they find someone else and they get married, and that person may come with $20,000 to $25,000 of debt.
Voila, $50,000 in debt.
All of a sudden, you're married, you've got all of this to deal with, and you're supposed to deal with it with a person who comes from a totally different background than yours and may deal with finances in a whole different way than you do. Their financial background is different. Maybe they come from a family that, you know, that spends like crazy, or maybe they don't, and that usually it doesn't match up. And so we're unprepared to know how to add now household and household debt to those financial issues and know how to deal with it.
Well, and you know, the truth is that most people, the way they deal with it is they just keep on spending. About 40% of Americans spend more than they make every year. How do you do that long term? But about 40% of Americans spend more money than they make on an annual basis.
70% of couples report that they talk about money issues on a weekly basis. But the problem is the talk usually turns into arguments, and it just becomes a negative thing that pulls them down. And personal household debt, and I just read this in an article just last week, personal household debt in America is $13.8 trillion. That is higher than the federal deficit of $12.2 trillion. Isn't that amazing? You know, we look at the government and we think, wow, look at all that debt. But that's the kind of debt that we have in just household debt, credit cards, things like that.
So it's not enough just to talk about it. You've got to do something about it. And the way to do that is to have a good problem-solving method. And we're going to teach one of those to you a little bit later in the next session, how to talk in a way that will help you actually do something about it, solve the problem, and then find some action. And that will be our next session. But it's important to recognize that this will create some damage in your relationship if you have this kind of debt. If you don't take care of the finances, first of all, it puts a stress on your personal relationships. It limits your options. There are fewer things that you can do as a family. You are more bound by the debt. You're more bound. One of the things that you can't do is if indeed one of you, the wife wanted to quit work to have the children and take care of them at home, with that kind of debt, you can't do this. You can't do it. And so it really limits your options as a couple.
So in terms of finances, one of the things you have to be able to do first is sit down and talk about it in a rational way. I know that right now is a tough time with a lot of people being laid off and those kinds of things.
It's rough.
So you have to be able to sit down and talk about it without getting into an argument. Like Mike said, we're going to talk a little bit about that later, how to have those problem-solving skills. And then look for help. There are many things out there that can help you. Crown Ministries has wonderful information and wonderful seminars that can help people get their finances in line so that it doesn't become this thing that's constantly dragging you down.
Now, that's an example of some of the big stuff that will impact a marriage, and we have to address those things. We have to be aware that they exist and be willing to use good problem-solving skills in order to address them so that they don't destroy you. But the truth is, all of us bring something into our marriage. For you, it may not be debt. For you, it may be something else. But all of us have issues we bring into marriage. In fact, we'd like you to watch this little video clip right now, and make sure the sound is turned up early on that, because I think it starts off a little bit soft. And this kind of illustrates what happens when we start a marriage. There we go.
This isn't what it looks like.
Really? Because it looks like rejects from a rehab center.
Listen, it's just all the stuff I was addicted to before I met you. Here, I'll stick it in the drawer. You'll never even know it's there.
It's all in the past, right?
What?
I said it's all in the past, right?
All in the past, of course. From now on, I'm only addicted.
I'm going to put this in the closet where it's out of the way, right here. Ted?
Yeah?
There's a girl in the closet.
Oh, that's just my old girlfriend, Kimberly. She broke up with me just before I met you. Don't worry, she'll stay in the closet. No big deal.
Talk about baggage.
We all bring something. You know?
Maybe it's a little over-exaggerated, but we bring stuff, don't we? We're human beings.
We've all got stuff we bring into the relationship. Right now, we were going to talk about some of the things that people bring into relationships, and maybe you've got some of these, maybe you don't. Maybe you know of someone who does. But it's important that we all be informed regarding these issues, things that we bring into a relationship that are going to have a very negative effect upon the relationship.
Or things that develop after you're married.
That's right.
Not necessarily that you had before, but just the big things.
The first thing that we want to talk about is pornography. This is a topic that nice church people don't like to talk about. And we don't want to admit that it exists. But you know what? It exists, and it exists in the church. In fact, I talked to someone the other day. We went to a convention for a religious convention for a group of Christians. And I talked to someone who said that when that convention comes into the hotel, that they do a bigger business on downloading pornography through the television system and buying for pornographic movies than with any other convention. So you tell me that it doesn't exist in the church. You tell me that it doesn't exist within nice churches like this church. It does. And today, with it being on the internet, it's just a click away and boom, it's there on your screen. In fact, sometimes you don't even have to ask for it. It pops up. Through an email that's unsolicited or through something else, it is there. And it makes a big difference. Does it hurt your marriage?
It does a lot of damage. First of all, it damages your spouse because it robs them of the time and personal attention and sexual attention that belongs only to them. There are certain things that belong only to your spouse. And when a screen or a magazine or a video or whatever it happens to be comes in between that, it's robbing that your spouse. It's not what God intended. It's not what you intended. It seems to happen, though.
The truth is that when you made the commitment for marriage, you also committed to having only one source to satisfy your need for sexual intimacy. Only one. That is your spouse. When you satisfy that any other way with any other source, even if it's just dots on a screen, you have violated the marriage contract. Because there's only one source of sexual satisfaction within your marriage, and that is your spouse.
And it robs both of you in another way. It robs you of marital satisfaction. You need to hear this statistic. It comes from Indiana University. And they found in their research that just 6 hours of viewing softcore porn is enough to destroy the viewer's satisfaction with his or her spouse. Think about that. And that's talking about softcore. That's not talking about some of the graphic sexual material that's out there. That's talking about more like just viewing the naked body, that kind of thing, maybe Playboy. 6 hours. Look how destructive it is. All of a sudden you're like, well, they're not as appealing. You know, this is easier.
The other damage that this does is this basically it's a broken contract. We promised that we would be exclusive for one another, and someone else has entered in. It may be someone you've never met, but they've entered into the relationship, and they've begun to rob you of the personal and sexual attention of your spouse because of the pornography. So it is a broken contract as well.
But still people ask, well, what's the big deal? And I hear people say, it's not like it used to be. We are not in this society that's so closed anymore. You know, it's more open. It's more accepted. It's all right. Everybody understands. That's not true. And when we buy into that, we buy into a cultural lie, a lie that tells us it's all right to step outside of our marriage vows, even with a screen. Let me tell you some of the truth about pornography. The truth is, number one, it devalues women. It reduces them to objects. Human beings have a deep need to be known and appreciated as a person. And when you view pornography, you become unable to see women as a person. They are devalued as an object, something to be attained, an item of entertainment.
Something to be used.
And women, women looking at pornography themselves, they also still are devaluing themselves and devaluing other women.
So it does devalue women. It makes women feel inadequate. But another thing that pornography does is simply it is addictive and progressive. Now, there's some argument in the psychological community whether or not there is such a thing as a sexual addiction. I know, what I can tell you from my counseling is that I know that there are people who find that they can almost not go a day without looking at pornography, and it's very difficult for them to stop looking at it. Whether that qualifies legally as an addiction or not, I don't know. But I do know that it's very, very difficult for some people to break away from it. It's something that has a hold of them. And by progressive, we mean it starts at one level. But usually, eventually, in fact, the studies show that this happens over and over and over again. The progress is this. It starts at one level, but after a while, this level of viewing material is no longer provides the buzz or the kick that it used to. And so you have to up the ante. And so you do something that's a little more graphic. And then after a while, that becomes less satisfying. And so eventually you go to the next stage. And eventually, someone's viewing material that they never dreamed that they would view over here. Over here that didn't even seem to be alluring to them or enticing. But now they find themselves viewing it and even finding that there's diminished return from that where they're even thinking about the next step. And so it is addictive and progressive in nature.
It also decreases the frequency of and the satisfaction with marital sex. Now, why is that? Is that because their spouse couldn't provide that satisfaction or that frequency? No, it's usually not that. It has more to do with the fact that they're caught in an unrealistic fantasy world. It's easier in the sense that if I am engaged with a real person, then I have to have a real relationship with mm-hmm. them. And you don't have to have a real relationship with a screen or a magazine. So, you know, there's not so much work there. Also, people tend to stay up late. They'll end up, you know, maybe all night long with a computer screen, and they don't even come to bed. And if they do, often they have taken those next steps in what they're comfortable with in sexual activity, and they're willing to do more over-the-line kinds of things. And so they ask their spouse for those over-the-line kinds of things, and their spouse is not comfortable with that, so they reject them, and they get in this cycle of, well, you're rejecting me, so I need to go over here to mm-hmm. get this. You see what happens? It's a very destructive kind of thing.
It also negatively impacts men's attitudes about women and sex. It has and again, the research is just, it's incredible, the volumes of research that demonstrate this. First of all, it increases the incidences of sexual violence, much more frequent in those who are viewers of pornography, much more likely to happen. It also tends to desensitize the viewer to sexual violence. Desensitize. If I'm watching a movie on television and an act of sexual violence takes place, I'm enraged. I want to do something. I want to stop it. I cannot stand to see violence against women. It drives me crazy. But if you watch that often enough, and if you watch pornography often enough, it desensitizes you to that act so that it's no longer such a big deal. You're used to watching it and doing nothing. You're used to watching other material, which then desensitizes you to the violence that is perpetrated against women.
It also increases the instance of depression in users. Did you know that? People who view pornography regularly and become addicted to it, they suffer more depression. And, you know, our mind is our most important sexual organ. And God communicates with us through our minds. We need to be looking at that point and keeping our minds clear so that we can not only, you know, keep the depression away, but keep that clear path to speaking with our God.
It also places children at risk. The number one place where men will claim that they viewed pornography first is they found their dad's stash, or they found his stuff on the computer, or they found the stack of magazines. That's where most men will say at a young age that they viewed it. And by the way, the younger you are when you begin to viewing it, the greater the impact it has upon you as an individual. And we're speaking primarily of men because that's where it is most frequent and most common by far. There are women who also have the same problems with pornography. Ordinarily, in most of these women, there is some sexual trauma from their past which has helped make them more vulnerable to this. But men, they don't have to have sexual trauma in order to find this appealing and to get caught into this dangerous web. And usually it begins by seeing something that dad had. So pornography in the home places children at risk. And if you think you can hide it from them, you're kidding yourself. They're resourceful. They'll find it. They'll find it.
So what do we do about it? Number one, you have to talk about it. You have to talk openly with each other, realize what's going on, and be willing to do something about it.
And that's easy to say, but difficult to do, because there's also a load of shame, guilt and shame, that accompanies the viewer of pornography. Intuitively, you know it's wrong. Intuitively, you know you're embarrassed about it when your wife finds it. And so it's tough to talk about it. But this is really the first step to healing, and the first step to getting help is to admitting it and saying, all right, this is going on. Let's do something about it.
So getting help, obviously, is the next thing. You can't fight the battle alone. It's an addiction. It's something that you need help with. Accountability, joining a group, and those two kind of can go together. You can have an accountability partner as an individual, or you can have accountability within a group.
And there are groups, Sexual Addicts Anonymous. There are all sorts of other groups that exist there in order to help you through with this. Don't be ashamed of that. Go get the help.
Get counseling, someone that can help you take step by step, one day at a time, just like any other thing that plagues us. We have to take it one day at a time.
Put filters on the computer that will prevent you from going there. There are all sorts of different projects and programs that are available. There's even one that I don't know if they're still in existence, but I know that you could sign up for it. And if your computer went to a place that was even questionable, the first thing you got an email from the person who's holding you accountable. And if indeed it continues, you get a phone call in order to hold you accountable for what's going on.
And basically, that's protecting you from yourself.
Yeah.
You know, often we need to protect ourselves from ourselves because we feel strong at one moment, but then later on we don't feel so strong. So if we can put some things in place, that helps.
And there are all sorts of other resources available. One of the places I direct you to is a book written by a former associate pastor of ours, a young man I helped bring into ministry. His name is Bernie Anderson. He's written a book entitled Breaking the Silence. He's a Seventh-day Adventist minister who had to admit he was addicted to porn and got help. In fact, he was an associate pastor of mine. When he recognized this, he called me over to his house and confessed it to me, and that began his journey to healing. And now he's written a book about it, and he does speaking engagements on this as he's calling men to sexual purity away from the addiction to pornography. And he also lists all sorts of resources that are available to you as well. And then the last thing is to set appropriate boundaries. And what I mean by this is, indeed, if your spouse has an addiction to pornography and is unwilling to do something about it, you may have to make some very tough decisions, but you have to set a boundary, because basically if you're the spouse of a person who's addicted to pornography, the truth is you deserve better than that. You deserve a contract that is held faithful. And indeed, you may have to set a boundary which simply says either you get help or something else happens. And that may be something like you leaving, or it may even, in severe cases, a divorce. It may be something else. Now, you don't set the boundary if you're not willing to enforce it. If you set the boundary, you got to enforce it. Otherwise, your partner knows you're not serious and nothing will change. But it may come to the point where you set a boundary. Those are things to happen in order to make this thing go away, in order to get help. But there is good news about this as well. And the good news is simply there is no downside to quitting. You don't lose anything. What do you gain? Less depression, better quality, more satisfying, and more frequent sex at home, which is the place you're supposed to be getting it anyway. Less shame, less guilt, and you put your children at less risk because you've stopped doing it. There's no downside to quitting. That's the good news.
So that's one. Let's talk about another big issue. It's called infidelity. What's the definition of infidelity? It's defined as a strong emotional and or physical attachment outside of marriage. Obvious, right? Anytime there's infidelity, we know that that's destructive. It's no secret that it's heartbreaking. It's no secret that it's damaging. But we need to take a look at it and say, you know, what can we do about it? What are the problems involved? What is the damage there?
Now, first of all, let's take a look at what affairs can look like. They can be purely sexual, or they can be purely emotional, or they can be a combination between the two of sexual and emotional. By the way, if you're trying to escape an affair and recover from one, that is the line, that how we've got them listed, sexual, emotional, and sexual and emotional. It starts with the easiest to break and goes to the most difficult to break. The easiest is actually that which is just purely sexual. If there's no emotional involvement with it, that is an easier one for couples to recover from and move on. The more difficult one is one that is actually purely emotional, because there's an addictive relationship that is formed in the affair. And then if it's sexual and emotional, the addiction is just that much stronger and it's harder to break. It can still be broken. I've counseled couples through this. I know it can be broken, and I know that there's life after it. But an affair can look any one of those three ways.
So what's the damage? First of all, an affair or infidelity is a lie. It's a lie to your spouse, obviously. You promised that you would be faithful only to them, and you find yourself in an affair. You're not being faithful, so it's a lie. And there are lies that are told within that.
Yeah.
You find yourself sneaking around telling lies that you never thought you would tell.
But it's also a lie to yourself. Because I've talked to people in the midst of the affair, and they say, but sex has never been better. I've never felt more emotionally attracted to someone. I found my soulmate. Truth is that that's a lie. And the long-term success rate of those who engage in those relationships, having broken their marriage and try to hold together, they realize that when the excitement and the adrenaline rush of getting away with something is gone, that what they had was simply an illusion. And they find that they've also entered into behavior that is near temporary insanity. I've had people, after the affair was over, come to me and say, why did I do this? What was I thinking? Why didn't someone stop me? And I said, I tried. I did my best to stop you, and you ignored everything we did. There's a temporary insanity, which on the other side of it, they say, what kind of an idiot was I? And so it becomes very detrimental that way. It is a lie to yourself. It's not as good as what the affair tells you it is.
It's also a lie to the third party.
Yeah.
Because there's an implied commitment there. There's an implication that, well, you know, you're going to leave your family and go with them. And
but,
it becomes a lie to them.
Yeah,
but
that's a lie to them, because in a study done of 4,200 executives who had an affair, of those 4,200 men, only 3% married the person with whom they had the affair. 3%. And of those 3%, 75% of those marriages ended in divorce. It's a lie to the third party. You're lying to your spouse, to yourself, and the third party. This is not wonderful, and you have not found your soulmate. That's a lie. It's an absolute lie.
It also breaks trust. And trust is essential in any marriage, in any relationship of intimacy. You have to have trust in order to give yourself to that person. And when trust is broken, it takes a long time to rebuild it. It is possible to rebuild it.
Yes,
so we don't want to paint this impossible picture.
No.
But it takes time. It takes months and years to rebuild that trust.
It also inflicts untold pain. And if you don't believe that, just ask anyone who's been through it. The pain that it causes for the perpetrator, the person who's involved in the affair, the third party, the offended spouse, children, family, church members, there are ripple effects from this, and it causes untold pain.
Infidelity hurts children. When children realize that their parents, that one is being unfaithful, it breaks the foundation of their world. They don't understand what has happened. Everything that they thought was true and that has created their world is now turned upside down. Sometimes they think it's their fault, especially if they're young. They feel like it's their inadequacy. Something must be wrong with me. Why would mommy leave? Why would daddy leave? Why would they need somebody else?
Daddy didn't just cheat on mommy, he cheated on me.
And they ask themselves questions later in life, like, will I do the same thing? Do I dare get married? Look at what dad did. Look at what mom did. And I'm an awful lot like her, or I'm an awful lot like him. Maybe I'll do the same thing.
I've seen young adults petrified of making a commitment because of the sexual infidelities of their parents, and just say, I don't want to do that to my children. I don't want to do it to my spouse or to myself or to anyone else. I don't know that I can enter into a marriage. And so it has a long-term effect upon people.
So what can you do? First of all, it takes an acknowledgement. You have to acknowledge the wrong and the pain that it caused and make no excuses. This says, I was wrong. I stepped out of my marriage vows. I should never have done this. And it's not making any blame on anybody else. It's simply saying, this is what happened. I acknowledge it. I acknowledge the pain, and I acknowledge that I was wrong.
Now, truthfully, in most marriages that are afflicted by an affair, there were things in the marriage that made both parties vulnerable. That does not excuse it. It may help explain why it happened, but it does not excuse it. And when indeed we're going to recover from this, the acknowledgement does not say, well, you have problems too, and we both have problems. That's not an acknowledgement. It's not a confession. That's a rationalization. The acknowledgement simply means is this. I don't care what was wrong in our marriage. What I did, what I chose to do was wrong. If you're willing to take that step, then you're well on the road to recovery, because you can recover with that kind of an attitude. Anything short of that, recovery is not going to happen. But with that attitude, I'm going to take full responsibility for this. That's when recovery can happen.
Breaking all contact is the next thing.
Yeah.
That is probably the most important thing that can happen. No contact with that third party again.
Remember that this individual has become, this is not so much a love affair as it is an addiction. It's a lie and it's an addiction. And every time you revisit that third party, the withdrawal from the drug starts over again. That makes sense? If indeed it's an addiction, every contact means that the withdrawal process starts all over again and the pain resumes again. All contact must be broken. I've seen couples, I've even advised couples, if you're able to do this, change jobs, move. Whatever it takes in order to there not to be any contact, because otherwise your marriage is going to have a hard time surviving.
We also have to be honest about pre-existing dysfunctions. That doesn't excuse an affair, but sometimes there are things that exist in our marriage that are dysfunctional, that are unsatisfactory, and they just make us more vulnerable to that happening. So if both of us then, you know, if we've experienced this in our marriage, experienced an affair, we have to step back and say, all right, what was it, if anything, that made us more vulnerable to this? Are there things that we need to fix?
And then rebuild trust. This is going to take some hard work. And remember that trust is not restored overnight. Trust must be earned. And truthfully, even if an affair has not taken place, trust must still be earned. Before Gail and I started traveling together, I did a lot of traveling without her. My calendar, I posted online for her to view. She knew exactly where I was every minute of every day. And she also had another right that I gave her. And that is the right to check on me any time she wants, no questions asked. My life is an open book to this woman. And if she wants to check on me, she has the right to call and check to make sure I was where I said I would be. Now, I don't know that she's ever done that. If she has done it, she's never told me and I haven't found out, and I'm just as well not knowing. I don't care, because I have no secrets from her. But that is in a relationship that hasn't been broken by this. How much more so for a relationship that has experienced this? Make your life an open book. It also means that the person who's trying to trust you again at some point is going to have to take a leap of faith. If indeed the marriage is going to be restored and you see some changes in the other person, then eventually you have to take some leaps of faith in order to speed this process along. Vulnerability is a key to marriage, and that means when trust is rebuilt, both parties have to be vulnerable and open.
The last part is ask and give forgiveness. And I suppose that goes along with the first one, actually, of acknowledging the wrong. But once we have asked forgiveness, forgiveness has been given, or at least you started on that path, because forgiveness is a process, then we need to leave it behind and let it go and be willing to move on. And that's when you can heal.
But there's good news, and that is the fact, oops, hang on, let me get this back here. There we go. You can survive the affair and you can be stronger. In fact, I got an email just a few months ago from a woman whose husband had had an affair. They walked into my office, and as I talked to them about this process before we began it, I said, I'm going to guarantee you something. If you'll do this work, and if you'll do the work that it takes to put this thing back together, you can be stronger than you ever were before, and your love can be stronger. The email said, I did not believe you when you told me that. It sounded like you were living in la-la land someplace, she said, like you had lost your mind. But now that we're a year and a half removed from the process, I want to tell you that it is true. I'm more madly in love with my husband than I've ever been before. When he walks in the door at night and our three daughters, scream, "Daddy's home," I realize how smart we were to put this thing back together. She said, just last Christmas, we were, as a family, decorating the tree, and it was time for the last little thing to be put on top, the angel on top, and he held our youngest daughter up as she put the angel on. And as she was doing that, he looked past her at me, where I was sitting on the couch, the children couldn't see, and he just mouthed the words, "Thank you." She said, I knew what he meant, and not only was I glad that I had done it, but I needed to thank him as well, because together we had built a stronger relationship, a stronger marriage than we had ever had. Pretty cool, huh? It can happen. You can recover. From there, let's go to the next one. We're on the track here to get through, and that is addiction. Addiction is a strong and growing problem in America, and it's not just out there in the world. It happens in the church as well. And it's not just someone you've won to the faith out of addiction. People in the church have this happen. And it can be because they experimented, or perhaps it is even a pain med that they used too long and began to find a dependency on. The truth is that this is a real and growing problem in America.
I'm going to give you a couple of quick facts about it. People who are divorced consume the highest levels of alcohol, and the lowest levels of alcohol consumption are found in those who are married. Now, you can... you can deduce a lot of things from that, but yeah. It's just interesting to see that those that are married drink less, those that are divorced drink the most.
Yeah, and those people who drink are more likely to divorce than those who are not, and the more alcohol you consume, the greater the likelihood of divorce. While alcoholics are just as likely to get married as non-alcoholics, their divorce rate and separation rate is at least four times that of the general population. So it has a very negative effect on the marriage.
Marriage to an addict is not truly a marriage, and I say that because of this. An addict will always choose their drug of choice over the marriage, over their children, over the family. It just has such a strong hold on people. It's not that they're bad people. It's not that they're unlovely people. It's that there's this terrible hold that Satan has through this drug or alcohol or whatever it happens to be. And so it's very difficult to have a marriage when addiction is involved, because the addict will choose the drug over those that they love, over their work.
Over everything, over God, you name it, because it becomes that strong of an addiction, that strong of a dependence. The other thing about addictions and alcoholism is this, that if indeed it stops emotional growth, if indeed you start abusing drugs at the age of 17 and then you stop at the age of 37, emotionally, guess what? You're still 17. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to stay 17. You can grow and you can become an adult again emotionally, but it stops emotional growth. This is one of the reasons why it is so devastating to the marriage relationship, because it takes a mature person to work through the problems that we have in marriages. And so, again, it does not mean that you're doomed to failure or you're doomed to a divorce. It just means you got a challenge because of the addiction, and that we can overcome, but it is a challenge.
There are some gender differences in the way that we approach this. Women who are married to alcoholics or addicts and have children in the home under the age of 18, 90% of women choose to stay in that relationship. But when men are married to an alcoholic or addict with children in the home, only 10% will choose to remain there.
Now, we don't know exactly what all that says.
Yeah, it's just a difference in the approach. And we see things different as men and women. Maybe it has to do with, motherhood, whether she feels like, well, my children will be better off if I have the support, if I'm here. A lot of different things, but those are just interesting things to look at.
It may be economic realities, that he has more of a position to remove himself from that situation and support the children. I don't know. There are a lot of things that doesn't tell us, but it does tell us that they do indeed approach it differently. Let's take a look briefly at some of the stages of an addiction. First is denial. No one wants to admit that either they are an addict or that they are married to an addict or an alcoholic. You don't want to admit that. And so the first time it happens, there are excuses made. Well, he partied a little too hard. It'll be okay next time. He won't do it again. Or, you know, she's never done this before. She was just experimenting. And so that's the first stage, is just simply denial. But eventually, the denial does not work. It happens too frequently. It's too often. It's too big a problem. And so there's the attempt to eliminate the problem. You've got to stop this. You know, I don't want this to happen anymore. There are threats that are made. There are cajoling, begging, pleading, whatever, in order to try to eliminate the problem. Let's not let this happen. And then when the problem is not eliminated, the whole family system falls into disorganization and chaos. People enter into unhealthy behaviors. It seems like everything's coming apart at the seams, and everything is found chaos. We're trying to keep the lie, but it's hard to keep the secret, but it's hard to keep it because outsiders are starting to know what the secret is. And so there's a lot of disorganization and chaos. Eventually, though, there is a reorganization in the marriage in spite of the addiction. And that means that usually the family enters into some codependent behaviors where you're able to lie about the addiction, you're able to keep the secret, and you function, but it's a very unhealthy functioning because people have entered into unhealthy roles in order to keep the family together. But that doesn't last for long. Eventually, there are efforts to escape. The spouse of the addicted person may want to try to get a divorce, or they just try to leave, or something else. And eventually then, there will be a reorganization either with or without the addict in the family. If the addict has been able to find help and get clean or sober, then the reorganization can be with the addict in the family. If not, then the reorganization may be without the addict in the family. But that is the usual pattern that it follows, the cycle of addiction in marriage.
So quickly, what can you do about it? First of all, is admit the problem. It's very difficult, and that's why you often hear in 12-step programs, the first step is to admit that you have a problem. The same thing in any problem in life. Refuse to keep the secrets, because the power is in the secrets. And when that is out, when that is open, you can start to deal with it and do something about it.
Also, there may come a time, if indeed there's still a lot of denial, where loving intervention will take place. Now, intervention is a word that has been popularized today. There are even TV shows about it. And it usually ends up being an opportunity for the whole family to pile on. And that's not an appropriate or a healthy way to do it. We'd like to recommend a book to you. It's entitled Love First by Jeff and Deborah Jay. And they discuss a true method of finding loving intervention when this is needed in the family. There is a healthy way to do this. Then also, it's important to seek help from AA, Al-Anon, Alateen, NA. All sorts of groups are out there. It may be that hospitalization is required. There's no shame in this. Go get the help you need. Counseling, accountability relationships, the whole gamut. Get the help you need because you can recover.
Set appropriate boundaries. And this is easier said than done because we enter into codependent patterns. But it's like Mike said a while ago, set boundaries that are appropriate and then be willing to keep them once you set them.
And don't lose hope. With God, all things are possible. Even I've seen families with addictions recover and move on and have healthy, productive married lives and healthy, productive children. This can happen. So there is good news, and the good news is that thousands have been victorious. It is possible to do this. You're not without hope. You're not without help.
Let's look at one more thing, and that is spousal abuse. I want you to listen to this definition because it's much broader than you might think. You know, we tend to look at spousal abuse and we say, oh, no one hits anybody in our house, and we pass it off. And yet in the church, we often have spousal abuse, and it's much more subtle at times. Listen to this from Barbara Hart. Domestic violence involves a continuum of behaviors ranging from degrading remarks to cruel jokes, economic exploitation, punches and kicks, false imprisonment, sexual abuse, suffocating actions, maiming, assaults, and homicide. Unchecked, domestic violence usually increases in frequency and severity. Many victims suffer all forms of abuse. Verbal and emotional abuse may be subtler than physical harm, but this does not mean that it is less destructive to victims. Many have said that the emotional scars take much longer to heal than broken bones. So note that it takes many forms. Christian homes have more emotional abuse than we want to think, often because we have a skewed view of what God means when he says that the man is head of the household. And we'll talk more about that later in the day. It's often tied also to a desire to control or feelings of self-hatred. There are so many things that go into it. It's worth us taking a look and saying, how am I treating my spouse, or how am I being treated? Because it's as hard to admit sometimes that you're a victim as it is that you're a perpetrator.
But here's something you need to know. Abuse is never the fault of the victim. Now, a victim think is, you know, if I had not said that, it would not have set him off. Or I really shouldn't have done that. Or if I should have known better than this, and that would, I really caused the pain. I really caused him to hit me. That's victim think. No one ever has the right to hit you, period. No one has the right to abuse you or control you, manipulate you emotionally, spiritually, physically. It is never the victim's fault. And to think that it is to think like a victim, and that means the cycle is not broken until you can change the pattern of thought.
You need to understand that when someone abuses, it's because they have made a choice. They have crossed a line and chosen to abuse. It may not have been something they said, well, you know, I think I'll just do this today. But it's a subtle choice that they make within their own mind and in their own heart.
And as Gail said, it is often tied to a need to control and feelings of lack of self-worth, self-hatred. And that's what causes them to want to control, because after all, the only way I'm going to keep this person is if I control them, because if they knew who I was, they wouldn't want me. And that's where the abuse comes from.
Some quick facts. 1 in 4 women will know domestic violence in her lifetime. Domestic violence is the leading predictor of child abuse. And get this one. Boys who witness domestic violence in their homes, these are boys, are 1,500 times more likely to perpetrate abuse later in life. 50% of girls growing up in an abusive home will go on to be victims of abuse themselves. And abuse follows predictable patterns. It tends to escalate in intensity and frequency until the cycle is broken. And you have all those things in your notes. You can take them and take a look at them later.
There's a pattern that abuse follows. And first, it would be we'll talk specifically about violence, physical abuse, although you'll find that emotional and spiritual abuse will follow some similar pattern at times. The first thing is, first there'll be in a first occurrence of violence. It will happen. And immediately after that, usually there is an apology. There's over-attentiveness. In fact, there's self-depreciating apologies. I'm so sorry. I'm the dumbest person on earth. It'll never happen again. And so they become very over-attentive. They overdo the love. They overdo the care. They overdo the watch care and the tenderness and the romance and that sort of thing. And then eventually, though, the tension begins to build, because they have lost a sense of compassion for themselves, a sense of worth, and their frustrations grow with themselves, and they tend to blame that. The pattern is to blame it on the person who is closest to them. And so the tension begins to build. And eventually, as that tension escalates, it puts them at very real risk. And all of a sudden, you realize the relationship is in trouble. Most victims of abuse will see this pattern, and they will feel that the tensions are growing, and they know that abuse is just around the corner. And then another violent episode will occur, and the whole cycle starts over again. The cycle can repeat itself on a daily basis, weekly, monthly, or yearly, or in some families, the physical abuse only happens once every few years. But the tendency is for it to escalate in frequency and intensity. Escalates in frequency and intensity. You've seen the news reports of some guy who just shot his wife or girlfriend and his children, and then shot himself or ran away and someone caught him. That's not the beginning of the story. It's the end of the story. But it started with episodes of violence that increased in frequency and intensity until it escalated to that point.
So what to do? Admit it. If you're victim or abuser, and sometimes it's just as hard to admit that you're a victim as it is to admit that you're an abuser. But realize that abusers are not bad people, they are broken people. There are things that have happened in their lives usually that tend to put them in this position of abusing someone else.
And victims must understand that the abuse is not their fault before healing can occur. You didn't cause it, it's not your fault, you deserve better. No one deserves to be abused.
Seek help, and we have things in your notes there with some phone numbers, hotlines for you. A safety plan is important if you're involved in any kind of physical abuse. realize that domestic violence is a crime and understand that you're not alone.
And may I add one more thing to this? Another form of abuse that we've not addressed here would be abuse from your past, from childhood, before you got married, if indeed you were the victim of some sort of abuse, be it sexual or physical or verbal or emotional, that will affect your marriage unless you have dealt with that trauma. It will have an impact because it will change your attitudes about yourself. It will change your attitude about the opposite sex and how intimacy is acquired. It will change everything. One piece of research indicates that at least 25%, maybe as many as 30%, depending on whose research, of all young women, by the time they reach the age of 21 in the United States, will have experienced some form of sexual molestation or rape. And that's in the United States of America. At least a quarter of all young women will experience some form of molestation, incest, or rape by the time they reach 21 years of age. And if you have been the victim of that, you owe it to yourself to get help. You owe it to yourself and to any future spouse to get help, or your current spouse. And help is available. You can actually recover from this and you can have a more normal life. This is not your fault. You did nothing to deserve it. You didn't cause it. You're not a bad person. You are a clean person and a pure person in God's eyes. He adores you and he weeps that this has happened to you. So don't go without getting the help, because healing is available for you. But there is still good news. And the good news is simply that you do not have to live this way. Help is available. You do not deserve to be the victim of abuse, nor do you deserve to have your marriage destroyed by past abuse.
So what's the best news of all? When you look at all of these that we've talked about, or any other big issue that tends to be in your life, there's hope. And that is that we have the grace of God who loves us. He's here for us. Jesus loves us. When you listen to all these things, it's kind of, oh, down, down, down. It sounds all so negative. And you maybe even start beating yourself up. You think, well, I can't communicate right. Listen to what we talked about last night. And, you know, I'm not as spiritual as I should be. We can beat ourselves up. But that's not what God wants us to do. Josh Harris tells a story. He says that he went to bed one night feeling horribly, horribly guilty. He had just this load of guilt on his shoulders. He was on a mission trip down in Puerto Rico. He was with the Billy Graham Crusade, and he was supposed to be there, you know, to be a part of this crusade and work for God and do all the good things. And he said he found himself one evening in the pastor's home. The pastor had gone out to do something, and he was clicking through the satellite channels on the pastor's television. And he came across one that was fuzzy, and he went past it, but then he came back to it, and it suddenly cleared up, and it was a pornographic channel. And he said, for some reason, he was just drawn into it, and he spent the whole evening watching porn. And he says, here I am. You know, I'm supposed to be doing stuff for God, and I'm such a hypocrite. And he went to bed just feeling a load of guilt. And while he was sleeping that night, he had a dream. And he dreamed that he walked into a room, and in that room were just hundreds of boxes that were like little file boxes like you used to see in a library where they would keep all the file cards for a library. And the boxes were all full. And he opened one, and he pulled out the first card, and the first card had his sin that he had committed that night of sitting and watching pornography, and his name was signed on it. And he said he started pulling other cards, and he realized that every card was one of his sins. Every bad thought, every time he had wronged another person, every time he had told a lie, anything he had done, and they were all in those boxes. And there were hundreds of boxes, and they all had his name signed. And he said, I didn't know what to do. And then the door opened, and in behind me walked Jesus. And he said, Jesus walked over, and he took that card out of my hand. And he took a pen, and he marked my name out, and he signed it, Jesus Christ. And he said, it was amazing, because he took the next card, and he marked my name out, and he signed it, Jesus Christ. And he began, it was almost like miraculously fast that it happened, that he had taken every single card, and he had written his name. And he says, I started to argue with him. No, you don't deserve that. He said, no, I've already taken care of that. It belongs to me. I died for you. I've taken care of every sin that you ever committed in the past. And you know what? The door's still open and those boxes will fill up again. And I've already taken care of everyone for the future. And he put his arm around him and they walked out together. That's the kind of God that we serve. It doesn't matter what has happened, what life has brought to us. He takes every card of every sin and signs his name instead of ours.
That's true. Scripture says, come unto me, all you who are weary and carry heavy burdens, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you. Let me teach you, because I am humble and gentle, and you will find rest for your souls. It's beautiful, isn't
Amen.
It?
We want you to take a couple of minutes here and just talk together about what are your big issues. Maybe it's something from here that we've talked about today. Maybe it has nothing to do with these. Maybe there are big things that stand in your way. Maybe you don't have any that you feel like are big, but you've just got things that you need to talk about. What are your big issues? And just take a moment, see if you can make a quick list, and then just make a commitment to say, hey, we're going to start taking the first steps toward these. You're not going to solve them this afternoon, but we're going to make a commitment to say, together, we'll overcome whatever these issues are by the grace of God, because he's the one that can do that.
Take a few minutes, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll come back with the next session. But right now, take a few minutes to discuss this. Do you have big issues? What are they? And what steps do you want to take in order to accomplish this? Programs. We leave those. Are they still in the car? Oh, that'd be great. Where do we put those? They're probably in the trunk. I'll go check the trunk. Why don't you, in a couple of minutes, send them on their break and tell them what we're going to do when they come back.
You're welcome to talk a little bit longer, or you can get up and take a break here for, let's take 5 minutes or so and just stretch and walk outside, get some fresh air. When you come back, we're going to have a drawing for fabulous prizes. Mm-hmm.
We're going to bring you back in here as soon as you've stretched your legs. We're going to have a drawing for fabulous door prizes. Well, door prizes. Maybe not fabulous, but door prizes. So get them back in as quickly as you can. We'll get started. Boys and girls, come on back. Come on down. You're the next contestants on Mad About Marriage. Come on down. We're going to have a drawing here. By the way, if you have filled out your registration, the seminar registration form, and have not turned it in, you need to get that into us, because that's what we're going to use to draw to get your door prize. We're going to give away some wonderful material here. And as soon as we get all those in, get you in here. Okay, we got a few more there. Gail's got. We're going to give away these. All right, these are the ones you filled out at the table. And so if you filled those out, that's all you need. If you didn't fill one out at the table, but you've got one in your packet and you filled that out, you turn that in, then you're covered. As long as we've got one of these, one of those places, we're good. Because we're going to use these for our drawing today.
We should be having this outside, shouldn't we? It's so pretty out there.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, springtime.
Yeah.
I know, we don't want to run anybody off. We're through the hard stuff now, right?
Now it gets fun.
Yeah.
Would I offend anyone? Would you think less of me if I removed this article of... Would that be okay? Now I'm going to do the really difficult thing. All right, thank you. You realize that men live on average 7 to 10 years shorter than women do, and it's because of neckties. You know that. We choke to death on the installment plan. Of course, my wife says that the only reason I can say that is because I don't wear pantyhose.
Most people don't wear pantyhose anymore anyway.
Well, that's true.
Right?
I guess it's
ladies
not
rebelled, most of them.
Not the fashion anymore, is
it?
Yeah.
Well, it depends.
All right, thank you so much. I may actually survive today now. All right, we're going to start drawing here for our fabulous door prizes. Oh, we got one more coming. Good, we don't want to start without you. Oh, thank you, sir. Isn't he good? You know, this man ought to get a doctorate in electrical engineering or something. I guess you're doing that, aren't you? He's almost there. Man, not only can he run it, but he could make it. He could build it. Thank you so much. Thank you, sir. He's been absolute gold. Thank you, buddy. All right, we're shuffling the deck here, you see. We're shuffling up all your registration forms, and boom, boom. Why don't you draw one of these? You choose any one. I don't care which one. Just draw one for me, all right? If she draws her, then we know the fix is in. Ken Molitor. Ken,
there?
Come on down. We're going to give you a book.
We have a book entitled Jesus, He's All You'll Ever Need. It's a book by Mike Tucker. Surprise, surprise.
Shocking.
Has stories from the book of Luke about Jesus.
I give away my own stuff because I can get it cheaper.
We have another book here titled 10 Keys to a Happy Marriage. And this is Relationship Secrets from the Book of Ruth. And we see...
Great, thank you.
Character, commitment, concern, those are the areas that we can learn about from the Book of Ruth.
And that goes to Yolanda Houston.
Is Yolanda here?
Yolanda!
Has she been here this afternoon? Okay, so they just are out for the moment, maybe? If she's here, if
Yolanda.
She was only here last night, not today, we'll give it to somebody else. But if she's still here somewhere, we'll save it for her, since I know not everybody's back in. Okay, you all, if you see Yolanda, holler, and we'll take it to her.
All right, we'll
put that right there.
Right there for right now. All right, why don't you find the next book?
This one is titled Meeting Jesus in the Book of Revelation.
Pull one of these for me.
Taking the fear out of the Bible's scariest book. And Mike wanted to title this How to Read Revelation and Sleep at Night. And sometimes, and the publisher wouldn't do it. Don't you think that would be a good title? Because I think sometimes we think about the scary things and we don't think of the positive.
And this goes to Dolores Brooks.
Is Dolores here?
Dolores?
Oh, there's Dolores.
Dolores wins.
All for you. Well, there you go. You got it.
Good, good. All right, from here, let's give away a series of DVDs. You want to do that?
Yeah, this is called Love for a Lifetime, and this is kind of the DVD version of the 10 Keys for a Happy Marriage book. This is also from the life of Ruth. It's a sermon series that was preached by Mike, and I think one of the DVDs is kind of flopping around in there, so you may want to open it up and get
Let's see. It looks like Dale... blah, blah, blah. Somebody, can you read that for me? And, is that
Anderson?
Okay, yeah. It must be a doctor.
Is Dale here?
Is Dale here?
He was here.
He was?
Okay, you think he's still here?
Oh, yeah, Dale, okay. Dale.
Okay.
I remember Dale.
All right, we know Dale. We met him. He was the first person we met when we got here.
That's right. He helped us unload our boxes. All right, you want to give this other stuff away? Or should we just, what do you want to do? We got three little books.
Give them as a group or give them individually?
What do you think?
I don't care.
All right, here we go. We got one entitled The Laws of Dating. Who's got a kid or somebody who's dating you need a book for? Okay, there's The Laws of Dating. That was written by Mike Tucker. We got a book on the Sabbath entitled